Last Sunday morning, I mentioned that we were going to draw from the life of David from sections of the Old Testament that many of us are reading these weeks, a look at our own life. I mentioned Paul Turnier's book, The Seasons of Life, in which he explores the way one moves from spring into summer, eventually into the fall or autumn of the lifetime. Shakespeare's All the World is But a Stage, the men and women are merely players, and the seven phases of life he pictures for man to walk through, to go through. Or Erik Erikson has eight stages of life into which he has divided our human existence. But numerous students of human nature have noted that some of us face one phase of life extremely well and another phase very poorly. And I think there's a great deal in David's life to learn about how to face the various things that face us in the changes of life. I remember an expression I heard very often as a child. It came at the end of fairy tales. Everybody knows it. And they lived happily ever after. I think it's sort of ground into the consciousness of a small child. After all, he's supposed to look at life as if it's a happy venture. We don't want him or her to realize just how serious problems may become later. So every story ends with the assurance, after a certain period of time, when all the dragons have been fought and all the curses have been broken, they live happily ever after. Prince Charming meets Sleeping Beauty and life is just wonderful. We come out of that choppy sea and into that tranquil port, and everything one has hoped for comes true. And so the child kind of grows up with a feeling that once he gets through his education and finds his mate and gets into his vocation and settles down, life will be very calm. But until that time, it's struggle. I think that's a wrong view of life. In fact, I know it's a wrong view of life. And that we'd be much better off if we could take our cue for facing life from the Bible. Jesus said in John 16:33, as he neared the end of his own life, in the world you will have tribulation. He doesn't limit that to one phase of life. It isn't during adolescence you're going to have tribulation. We talked about that last week. The incident in David's life when he finally went out to meet Goliath, even though Saul and his three brothers thought him incompetent to do it. They let up without letting go, and David broke loose without destroying the relationship, and the expansion of relationships took place, and adolescence for David allowed a growing period. Jesus notes that wherever one is in life, he's going to have tribulation. It isn't limited to adolescence. It isn't limited to adulthood or senior adulthood. That's life. But lest we allow the realism to turn into pessimism, he says, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. We're going to have tribulation in the world, but through him we can become more than conquerors. That's the message of Scripture. He doesn't pull us out of the trials of life. He simply gives us the strength and wisdom to cope with them so that we can emerge conquerors of life instead of being conquered by life. Now, the longest phase of life any one of us faces, it sometimes lasts as much as 40 years, is what we may call adulthood. That period between adolescence and senior adulthood. And in this period of time, although adolescence may be more and more intense period in the struggles one goes through, we face the greatest demands of our lives. It's not only because it's a longer period, it's just a more demanding period in many ways than any other period of life will be. Paul Turnier pictures the parents standing at the crib of a little child. And they begin to be concerned about the success of that child. And he notes it isn't just because they're concerned for the child, but subconsciously at least they know that if the child doesn't succeed, this means that we haven't succeeded. And there's a drive for success. Or he raises the question, why does that industrialist push himself so hard that he gets a heart attack? He knows it's coming, but he goes anyway. Is it just to get more money? Of course not. It's because the business he has built must keep on building or he's not judged to be a success any longer. So we have that drive for success. And it's especially keen in adulthood. And I think there's something in David's life that we may learn that will help us to reach the kind of success we really want to reach. I was reading not very long ago from a student of human nature who observed that what we really need in adulthood is what she called concomitant growth. She said there are a lot of frontiers in a person's life, and sometimes we grow very well on one and we miserably fail on others. She illustrated with a 46-year-old television newscaster she had known. He had achieved national fame. He'd climbed to the very top of his profession. But then he reflected to her how he felt being at the top. He said, "You know, I'm very close to the top of that mountain that I set out for as a youth. But what I find here is not very much snow, but an awful lot of salt." As one looks up to the peak of the mountain and wants to climb there, it all looks like beautiful snow. But he was saying, "I've moved through various relationships. I've not really created any intimacy in my life. And now here I stand looking out at life from the peak of the mountain that I wanted so badly to climb, realizing that somewhere between the ages of 12 and 14, I concentrated everything in life on one frontier, work. And so I have no deep relationships. I have not cultivated the self. The self has not grown. And the result is that I stand here with no navigational charts with which to descend the mountain." If you think that's just a 20th century phenomenon, I want to turn back 3,000 years and show it happening in the life of King David. I believe it's there in a very vivid fashion. On those very frontiers, work, family relationships, and the growth of the self, David did very well with number one. In his work, he was really a success. David went all the way from a shepherd boy within 5 decades to a position as uncontested king from over all the land from the Nile in Egypt to the Euphrates in Mesopotamia. If you look at a map of the Middle East, that's a very large area of land. David has climbed from the position of an obscure keeper of sheep to such a position of fame and power. There were lots of reasons why David did that. One reason was that he was never worried about his own security. David was always able to do things for Israel's good and growth instead of worrying about himself. I was helped some time ago by that insight when I read from a man who had the job of hiring executives for a corporation what he looked for. He said, "When I'm looking at a person who might be a potential executive, I want a person who wants to do something. I don't want to hire a person who wants to be something." As he explained the difference, the person who wants very badly to be something will never have security enough to make decisions that involve risk. He'll always be afraid, "I won't succeed if I do that." So he wanted a person who is satisfied with what he is, but who wants to do something. That was David. David wasn't trying to be something. He simply wanted to do something. He had lots of attempts to make himself great. But instead, he spent all of his energy trying to make Israel great. Think about some cases. King Saul was very unfair to David. Although David had entertained him with his playing, had been a very loyal citizen, Saul chased him all over Palestine trying to take his life. David had more than one opportunity to kill King Saul, but he refused to do so. On one occasion when Saul came into a cave, David slipped up stealthily behind him and cut off the skirt of his robe. When Saul left the cave, David went out later and said, "Why are you believing those people who tell you that I'm a traitor? Look at this skirt of your robe. The Lord delivered you into my hand. I could have killed you. Why don't you believe this instead of those people?" But Saul wasn't able to accept it. A little later, he was chasing David again. When Saul died, you'd almost think David would go around rubbing his hands with glee and saying, "Well, I'm glad the old scoundrel's finally dead. He's chased me for years, and sooner or later he might have caught me." That wasn't what David did at all. Instead, David wept with all Israel that Saul was dead. Saul's field commander was named Abner. Abner came and made peace with David eventually. But Joab, David's field commander, murdered Abner. And David lamented the death of the great man in Israel. "A prince and a great man in Israel has fallen this day." And he said, "These sons of Zeruiah are too hard for me." David couldn't understand people who had to kill people who did something bad to them. He wanted to do something for Israel, not to be something for himself. After Saul was dead and Abner was dead, the northern tribes kept clinging to Saul, wanting his son to be their ruler. Southern tribes had crowned David their king down at Hebron. Eventually, the northern tribes saw they weren't going to be able to succeed like this, and they came to David and asked him to be their king. There were reasons. They did it because of the way David reacted to the death of Saul and the death of Abner. The fact that he was willing to lament those deaths instead of to rejoice in them made the other people want to be his servants. But now David has his chance. He can say to all those northern tribes, you come down to Hebron and do obeisance to me. Admit you were wrong. Accept my leadership. They've already come to him asking him to be king. But you remember what David did? There was a city which had been kept by the Jebusites, and the Israelites had never been able to drive them out. David went up and drove the Jebusites out and changed the name of Jebusalem to Jerusalem and made it the capital of his new kingdom. It was his way of uniting the two parts of the kingdom. He was a great worker. He didn't have to establish himself. He tried to establish the good of Israel. He passed from that place where he leaned on other people to the place where he was willing to be the father figure, the parent figure, and lead Israel. Eric Erickson calls that generativity. He says it's one thing to bring children into the world, and it's another thing to get to the point where you no longer want to lean on your parents. You want to be strong and let other people lean on you. David made that transition, and it's a tough one to make. But that's the way he handled work in his adulthood. David was a man who put everything he had into his work, and he succeeded because he was building Israel. He wasn't building himself. But let's turn the page. There's another frontier, family relationships. How was David doing there? Not very well. I mentioned the 46-year-old TV newscaster a while ago. He told this student of human nature how he had discarded wife after wife on the way up the hill to find the salt, as it turned out to be. It's much easier to form superficial relationships than it is to form a deep, long-lasting relationship. That takes a real investment. It takes a willingness not to run away when things get a bit difficult. That's what David never quite found. He married wife after wife, but he never had one single relationship that seems to be intimate in those stories of his life. In our discard, trade-in civilization, where when the car gets something wrong, we simply go down and trade it in, we tend to take the same tack toward relationships. If our relationship with this companion doesn't work, we trade this one in, get another, and try all over again. That was what happened to King David. And now he found himself, the older he got, the lonelier he got. I think one of the saddest scenes, if not the saddest scene in all the life of David, is when he's lying near death and he's suffering chills. And they have to send out and scour the kingdom of Israel and find a young lady named Abishag to bring in and lie with him. He had no one who stood in that intimate position. They just had to keep bringing more people for his superficial relationships. What about his children? The Old Testament describes David as having 19 different boys, that his 19 sons are named, and an unnumbered group of daughters. I don't know how many children total, and yet he seems not to have had an intimate relationship with any of them. They quarreled and connived and betrayed one another. Amnon forced Tamar. Absalom killed Amnon. Absalom led a coup d'etat against his father. Adonijah, when his father lay dying, tried to take over the kingdom by force, even though it was supposed to go to Solomon. David suffered in those relationships with his children because I don't know what all those children had, but they never got very much time with or guidance from their famous father. And that shows up in the way their lives turn out. Well, David had some tender spots in his heart. When Absalom led the rebellion and was killed in it, David gave that great lament, O Absalom, my son, Absalom, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son. But he appears not to have really invested himself and his time into those relationships with his children. And the deep relationship can't be created instantaneously. There's still another frontier. What about the development of his own self? Not just work and family. But you're a unique person with unique gifts from God, talents that he intends to be developed and used. How are they developing? Well, I don't think David had much time to develop his. He was too busy working. He was a workaholic in our modern terms. Someone has commented that the adolescent is sometimes too preoccupied with himself or herself. But the adult has to be preoccupied with self part of the time. There must be periods of meditation. Oh, David wrote some beautiful psalms. Many of them he must have written after his heart was broken over the sin with Bathsheba. But there are indications that he hadn't really grown inside as he should have grown. Several students of human nature have commented, Emerson, for example, there's nothing rarer in any man than that man's own act. We usually live somebody else's life. What somebody else wants us to do is what we do. If someone should ask, but what do you really want in life? We might feel lost because we're living out what somebody else expects of us. Someone else wanted me to do this, and so I do it. Do you know there are more suicides on Saturday and Sunday than on all five of the other days of the week put together? Do you wonder why? Well, careful students of the situation think it's because all week long our lives are structured. Somebody else is telling us what they expect of us, and we do what we're supposed to do. And then we have what psychologists call a weekend psychosis. All of a sudden we have to structure our own lives, and we don't know what we want to do with ourselves. And so we fail, sometimes that miserably. That's what the text was about this morning. Year after year, David had gone out to battle with his army. But this particular spring, David didn't go. And he appears not to have known what to do with himself. He's getting old enough, he doesn't want to go to battle anymore, at least not every year. And so he walks around on the roof of his house, lies on his couch a time, then his eyes fall on a beautiful lady who's bathing across the way. And he inquires about her and sends and takes her to himself, commits adultery with her, discards her as quickly as he took her. David seems not to have asked himself what he was going to be and what he was going to do with himself. The boy who was chosen as a shepherd lad by God to be the king of his people now does an instantaneous act that breaks his own heart as well as the hearts and lives of others, because he doesn't really take the time to allow that inner self to develop into what it ought to be. You and I live in a sensate culture, and we're becoming increasingly more aware of it. There are all sorts of appeals constantly made to break down the resolution of the heart and to bring us to the level of animal living. And the only people who are going to survive this attack are the people who take the time to decide what they're going to be and to do. That's why adulthood presents such challenges. Now, I've known people who spent all of their time in work, as David appears to have, and just didn't develop in relationships or in their own selfhood. I've known other people who spent all of their time on the family, and they seem never to have had any interest beyond the confines of their own families. They did poorly at work. They did poorly in the development of the self. And I've known still others who wanted to do their own thing and nothing else mattered. They seem not to be concerned about their family or their work. What I believe the life of David calls out for is balance. Concomitant growth. Growing on all those frontiers at the same time. Living the balanced life Jesus Christ lived among and before men. Where deep relationships can grow. Where the work of one's life is taken seriously. And where the self has its opportunities to grow as well. I believe the scriptures hold a clue to modern living, just as they did to ancient living. That we can find a mirror of ourselves in any situation in life somewhere in the pages of this book. And from a David, we ought to be able to learn that it takes investment of the self in all of those areas. But that investment begins with an obedience to Christ. Do you need to begin while we sing?
Thank you.
Will you be seated a moment?